Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Hanna Zeevan is a lecturer in the Departments of English and History at the University of California, Berkeley, and is on the Executive Committee of the University of California at Berkeley Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and on the Executive Committee of the Berkeley Center for New Media. Additionally, she is a visiting fellow at the Columbia University Center for the Study of Social Difference. Dr. Zeevan's first book, The Distance Cure, A History of Teletherapy, is out now from MIT Press with a foreword by Dr. John Durham Peters. She is currently at work on her second book, Mother's Little Helpers, Technology in the American Family, which is set to be published by MIT Press in 2023. Dr. Zeevan serves as an editorial associate for the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Association and is a co-founder of the STS Futures Initiative. Other work has appeared in or is forthcoming in The Guardian, the Los Angeles Review of Books, Real Life Magazine, Slate, The Washington Post, Logic Magazine, and beyond. Dr. Zeevan received her BA from Yale University in 2012 and her PhD from the Department of Media, Culture, and Communications at NYU in 2018. All right, Dr. Hanna Zeevan, welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Pete.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on today. I'm really, really looking forward to discussing some of the themes in your new book, The Distance Cure, A History of Teletherapy. This conversation is, of course, so very timely. It's been absolutely fascinating to watch the ground, in a sense, completely shift in the world of psychotherapy owing to the changes we've all had to make essentially overnight from the beginning of the pandemic. I think literally every day I'm struck by a potentially new implication of the widespread adoption of this mode of delivering therapy. I know at our practice, we're seeing big shifts in client and even clinician preferences. I also think there's some really potentially massive big picture implications that I want to explore with you. So all this to say, Hanna, I'm really, really looking forward to the conversation. Thanks again for coming on.
Of course. Thank you. And me too.
I think I wanted to start by sharing one little anecdote with the listener, just in terms of a reflection on my own experience of this migration over to teletherapy. And then we'll jump into the conversation. But I distinctly remember at a case discussion meeting or a check-in we had at the practice, perhaps in maybe April of 2020, where I remember saying something to the effect of, if this is what the job was like forever or always was, I would unsubscribe, like something to that effect, where I had really no, I was really angry and really bucking against sort of the adoption of the teletherapy. It was so disruptive to the way that I was normally undertaking my practice. But fast forward till now, and in some ways, I couldn't be more delighted with the way that the model has sort of played out on some level. I'm fully set up in my basement, very comfortable with the tech and whatnot. So it's just been so interesting to compare my imagined reality of a mostly teletherapy-based practice versus the actual implementation of it. So I'm not sure what you've heard on your end from your conversations, but as a reflection, that's what it's been like for me thus far.
Yeah, I think that maps to some of what I've heard. You know, the book, which is, you know, it's a historical book and it's theoretically driven, but it's a history. You know, there are lots and lots of archives that includes through to not the present, but to last summer, an early moment in the pandemic. And it's intense that we're starting to really periodize early pandemic, mid pandemic. I'm not optimistic. And some people are saying late pandemic, I'm not there yet. But, you know, so the book does have a coda on the early pandemic, the first March, April, May, and finished in June. So 4 months, called When Distance is Everywhere. And for that, I did a lot of interviewing, not just with colleagues who are facing these changes like you, but also who had been in the book earlier at different moments. So it worked as the book's coda, but the whole book was written pre-pandemic, other than that. And so I witnessed, just like anyone else, you know, from as far as my lab, this massive change that happened for us. It was October 13th. Was March 13th, 2020, where, you know, at first, actually, no one quite said, I hate this, I want to quit, because everyone knew they had to do it. That it was not going to be possible to see their patients in office, lest they risk their own health the health of their patients, and not just physically and physiologically, but also psychically. Because the pandemic has these, like anything that's happening in the outside, these intense resonances with what's happening inside. So, you know, if a patient used to have a fantasy, my analyst wants to kill me, could kill me, can harm me. Well, now it was quite concrete, right? And that admixture was very frightening for clinicians I talked to. So the switch to teletherapy just kind of happened overnight. Itself is kind of traumatic. But everything was, right? And the switch to distance was for everything, for school, Zoom happy hours. You know, it was, we really resituate in that. And then now, a year and a half later, now I hear more of this, either if this is going to be forever, I don't want to do it, or I'm never going back. And very few people sound somewhere in the middle, right? Or, you know, there are a few. I'm going to have a hybrid practice. But people have really now redrawn camps that existed before the pandemic, except now there are more people having this conversation than ever before.
Very, very interesting. It's just so amazing that you had this book in the works, and then the timing couldn't have been more immaculate in terms of the release. And I'm sure that was not by design. It was just serendipitous, but just an amazing coincidence.
And just to say, I've been working on the book for almost now a decade, so then 7 years, 8 years. So yeah, it was completely accidental and very strange. Teletherapy, I argue in the book, is therapy shadow form. And it allows us to re-see the history of psychology via that shadow form. And by the time the book came out, teletherapy was the dominant form of care on offer. Yeah, it was strange.
Absolutely. Hannah, what are some of the biggest misconceptions that many psychotherapists are likely to be laboring under with respect to the history and deployment of teletherapy? There was lots of surprises in the book for me, just with respect to the actual versus perceived history of teletherapy and how it actually has been employed for quite some time.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So I think the way to do that is with when I talk about the people who are very against teletherapy. And I should say, I'm not like a teletherapy evangelist. I wrote a history of the form and the forms. So that would be the first thing, which is to say that teletherapy has been offered by every conceivable medium across therapy's history, starting with letters, you know, broadcasts, podcasts, of course, but broadcasts first, the landline before the cell phone, early internet clinics, the earliest mainframe computers, right? It's been always there. And that's the first argument in the book, that teletherapy, far from being a recent concern, yes, in the pandemic or in the sort of Silicon Valley startup moment, is as old as psychoanalysis itself. And so a lot of people will say to me, yeah, but Freud would have never done this. Freud would have never tolerated it. And my response is always, well, that's not really the case. That Freud was, as we know, very invested in thinking through psychoanalysis as like various kinds of media. He loved metaphors, and beautiful writer. It's, you know, always such a pleasure to sit with Freud as a writer. And also invested in making use of real media, mostly the postal system, not just for treating patients, but also for treating himself. That what I call Freud's analysis, others would call Freud's self-analysis, was done via the post. It was a written cure. And that Freud, in fact, took free association from writing. So there's always these other media that have been part of psychotherapy. So when we privilege the room as the proper site, that's an intervention I want to make. It is a site, and for some it is the best site or the only site. But there have been these other spaces, mediated spaces, that have convened the therapeutic relationship just as properly.
I think you've made a really important point, and this comes up in the book. And again, I think there's the potential for it being a bit of an eye-opening moment. Hannah, can you speak a little bit more about how every therapeutic exchange, whether in the office or not, is mediated in some respect? You referenced this sort of triad that the therapist and the client are always enmeshed with on some level. I think this may not be obvious to clinicians. It certainly wasn't to me, but it gave a really fascinating and deep frame to psychotherapy. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that just a little bit more.
Totally. And, you know, I think when people talk about the attendant loss of in teletherapy, which I talk extensively about in the book throughout. But I think one thing that we can reframe that is a loss of a particular set of mediations, some of which do recede in teletherapy and others which don't, even though we think they do. So yeah, I say that what a clinician would call the frame, what we would all call money, these are, you know, the greeting, the ritualized aspects of the therapeutic encounter, which, you know, is something that people really miss. They didn't like accepting payment on Venmo. They didn't like the fact that you click out of the Zoom room, which I understand that feels abrupt. They miss these settings, the setting, the frame of the in-person encounter. And I say, yes, and that's a mediation. That's one place it's happening. And then the other argument I make is that ever since Freud stopped laying hands on his patients as part of hypnosis, a lot of things happened. And one thing that happened is that he introduced distance and boundaries, and that those boundaries, that distance of the couch, series of framings that we all sort of took for granted more or less up until March 13th or 17th, 2020, are already doing a great deal of work, and they were already flexible. So, you know, I show that you know, if for Freud, the proper frame was 6 days a week, for others in the UK, it was five. And, you know, in the US, it was four, and so on. And that even the most sort of basic elements were always ever shifting. And also media, additional media, like the letter, like the phone, were also always already involved.
And can you talk a little bit about maybe the cultural frame or cultural mediation? There was a point that you made perhaps in another podcast I was listening to, how when the clinician and the client are speaking within the office, they're both maybe not attuned to how much heavy lifting or work the cultural context is doing for them in that moment, or it's certainly part of the interaction in a way that maybe neither party is really appreciating or perhaps is just taking for granted.
Well, you know, so totally. I think that that's true when there's a kind of assumption of homogeneous relationality between the clinician and the patient. I think, you know, a lot of the people who have brought the social into the clinical more firmly also talk about how that's never the case, right? And especially, you know, in terms of race or class or gender. So feminist psychoanalysts, feminist psychotherapists have been talking about this for a long time, that the woman patient might be quite aware of how the culture is circulating, and that the, you know, the male psychoanalyst not, or is, but is disavowing it. And, you know, one thing that I saw across the book were that there were moments where that homogeneous quality of patient was assumed in order for the thing to work, like with the broadcast. Every single patient, the whole audience, has to be assumed to more or less have the same problem. Otherwise, it's not going to work or be of interest, et cetera, except for in like a voyeuristic way, of course. And other places where, in fact, it's going to be much more customizable, like, say, in terms of the encounter on the suicide hotline. So, you know, going back to your earlier question, that was also one of the things that surprised clinicians, was that I was granting these kinds of mediated forms of care an equivalence via yoking them under the sign of teletherapy. And again, it disrupts an idea that therapy is always for the fee, always in the office, that the patient is kind of homogenous, and that there is that they can access and pay for the clinical encounter. And I know you're in Canada and I'm in the US, and those are very different histories. But in the US, not that the whole book takes place here, that's, you know, that is a huge problem and remains one, that, you know, therapeutic encounters are incredibly expensive. Talk is not cheap.
No, that's for sure. Hannah, many clinicians want to ensure that their practice is, you know, evidence-based. And generally speaking, what does the data say around teletherapy? Are there any conditions or presentations where it's now understood that it should not be deployed? Or are there any instances where there's a special advantage to employing distance therapy?
I'm really interested in these kinds of studies because they're, again, I want to put the right caveat there. This is a historical book. I'm not a clinician, though I have many sympathies and connections to the clinical work. So there are a few different things to say. One is that starting in like the 1990s, there were started to be studies on computer-based CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And at this point, it's understood that CBT delivered by machine, by computer or smartphone, is as effective, if not more effective, than being delivered by a human. And the book has a deep argument about why that is, that CBT was actually set up for that eventuality, that as long as we've been trying to make chatbots say mimic humans, psychotherapy has been a litmus test, like the Turing test, for that mimesis. But in terms of teletherapy, like we're doing right now to do this call, not teletherapy, but on Zoom or on the phone, there's an equivalence. It's no better, no worse. It's different. So of course, there are going to be patients for whom it's not ideal. And there are going to be patients for whom it's ideal. There are going to be patients for whom only the in-person office functions. And there are going to be people who can only access teletherapy. And so I think that's when we do come to late pandemic, which I don't think we are at yet, these are going to be real conversations about how to maintain access without further compromising therapeutic labor, which has already been made to be hyper-flexible, always on, in part because of media. So it's not, again, this is not a sort of evangelizing narrative where teletherapy is only awesome, especially not when it becomes corporatized. But there are also these huge imports, both in the history and in the present, where, you know, in terms of disability, in terms of economic access, it is a major way forward too.
Oh, for sure. Just in what you said there, there's so many, I think, threads to pull on, and I'm really hoping we can get to those and some questions I have just a little bit further down the line. Just to hang on this topic just for a moment, from your lens, you know, is there any coherent argument for a third-party payer not reimbursing for services delivered by teletherapy, or really even differentiating between them for even like bookkeeping or accounting purposes? I know for some of the third party folks who I submit to, I've got to denote it as a teletherapy session versus an in-office. And what the sense I got from your book and from this conversation already is that that distinction on some level is artificial, if I can use that word. So yeah, is there any coherent argument for not reimbursing or for even, you know, differentiating between the different modalities?
Yeah. So I think at the insurance level, so I just want to underscore, they are different, good and bad. And I'm also not that interested in narratives of lesser or greater, which is to say, like, I'm interested in the specificity. Like, what is it about the telephone call in the 1950s that protects, queer callers in the Tenderloin from psychiatric intervention, where the DSM has homosexuality, which was the, you know, definition, as a disorder? That, you know, but there are lessons to be learned from each of these specific moments. So they are different, and they shouldn't be treated as such economically in this sense, right? That because it does allow for, this very painful, punitive reach of insurance companies, which is not on their end about whether it's better or worse that you see your patient one way or another. It's about trying to not reimburse, period. And so any place that we can push back and demand true parity for mental and physical health care, I mean, first of all, in the US, that would only get you so far because the physical health care system is such a mess too. But we don't have that in the US even, right? Where Medicaid and Medicare have true parity for mental health. One thing that was strange at the start of the pandemic was that a number of the big insurance companies here did overnight drop the copay for teletherapy. And so did really support that term. And I think I haven't seen enough about this, but as a result, I know anecdotally, every, you know, no one has any time, it seems, no provider sort of at any level. But they're also no more, the laborers are no more economically secure. So I'm interested in what happened there, and need to pull more threads to figure it out. And that is really a US specific point, but in general, no, they shouldn't be differentiated like more expensive and less. That's how these corporations have flooded therapists, you know, caseloads, but they're making less money than ever. $10 a session, $20 a session, and making, you know, less than the minimum wage is federally mandated. It's really upsetting.
Absolutely. Again, I can't wait to get to some of the questions I have around some of these more systems level issues and some of the things I've been thinking about recently. Just to ask you a question about something that came up in the book, especially in the coda, I thought was really interesting. You had mentioned just anecdotally some of the reactions that clients have had to seeing their therapist in the home environment, namely catching a glimpse of their life outside of the therapeutic frame, like a child wandering, you know, into the room or knocking on the door or hearing a pet make a sound, or basically some cue that the therapist has a life outside of the therapeutic relationship and exists outside of the therapeutic frame. I wonder if you could just maybe tell the listener a little bit more about some of the anecdotes you heard around this, because I thought that was, you know, from a therapist perspective, a really fascinating observation.
I mean, so I think most therapists, you know, have a version of this from the last 18 months to draw on, which is that, okay, so there's the in-office frame. We know what it's like. And we have the Zoom frame or phone frame. But I think, you know, I was always so pleased when people would tell me, I don't do Zoom, I only do phone. I think that that tended to, for a lot of people, to go better. And we can talk about why that is. But, you know, just like if you're working in an office suite with four other psychotherapists, a patient could open the door on a session, right? Their first time, they think it's the bathroom. Or a delivery person, right? You know, these kinds of ruptures do happen. They really do. We would have ruptures also on Zoom. But these ruptures or these interruptions, these perforations, because now we weren't in the workspace, we were in the home space, were understandably much more personal. And patients were able to look, if they wanted to, for context clues about the personal in a different way, right? So part of one of these early rituals that we have in the psychotherapy office is that we stage it, not like a house about to be for sale or something, or like a soundstage, but it's staged nonetheless. You, if you have a photograph of your child at your office, it's a choice. If you have your degrees up, it's a choice. If you don't, that's also a choice, et cetera, right? The color of the therapist chair. And so at home, people were trying to make do. I'm glad that you got set up in your basement, but, you know, lots of people right at the very beginning were just trying to find a corner in an apartment with their two kids who are home and loud while they were doing homeschooling, while their mother had moved in with them, and so on. And like a million cats, you know, there's this, always the cats jump, cats love computing and computing loves cats. And it gave a different feeling to the therapeutic encounter. It was less quote unquote neutral. And I think that neutrality in the therapeutic encounter, that kind of stagedness, is something that people are paying attention to anyway right now for all kinds of other political and sociological reasons. And so it's not only better or worse. It allows there to be more material to discuss. Like, what is the meaning if I really do have a child? And you've really been convinced for 7 years I don't. But that would have never come up in that staged frame. And so for some patients, that was exciting, if not a little titillating. And for other patients, it was too much, right? And I think that's another thing we can think about with the Zoom therapy turn in our present, just to conclude here, which is to say that, you know, the assumption was we've lost so much when we shift to Zoom. I can't see what I would see in the office. And I think actually what a lot of people remarked upon is both sonically and visually, it could be too much. that forced eye contact, which Freud, that was why Freud kept the couch. There was no other reason for it. It was a hangover from hypnosis. He didn't like patients looking at him and he didn't want to look at his patients. A lot of people tend to agree. It's too much. It draws on a lot of energy to make consistent eye contact. But also, you know, this kind of reveal of the home, as well as patients grabbing the computer and getting into bed in pajamas because the bed was the only place of privacy. Suddenly you're in bed with your patient, right? Which has all kinds of meaning and would never, we hope, happen in the staged encounter.
So Hannah, is that what you're alluding to very briefly just around the phone versus Zoom? I know in practice I've migrated to sort of a model of maybe a 50-50 blend ultimately. Being on Zoom all day is a little much, but being on the phone exclusively is not a great fit for some of the work that I do. And ultimately a blend seems to be sort of the most sustainable model for client and clinician alike. Is that what you're getting at there, just in terms of the intensity level can be sort of moderated on the phone a little bit more perhaps than Zoom?
I think that there are a few things. One is that, like, look, again, clinicians have to figure this out for themselves and in their what I call triads, right? It's the clinician, it's the patient or patients. And we can talk about couples therapy if you want. Child therapy is also different, and the medium. And I think that for some, not having to compose the face, not having the face reflected at one's face, you know, as in Zoom and so on, is all really much more like a kind of therapeutic work. And for Freud, right, psychoanalysis was always like a telephone call, even if he's totally wrong about it in terms of a literal media materiality. He gets all the details wrong there, but the metaphor stands. And for others, you know, Zoom is going to introduce really productive play. So, you know, the patient who does not reveal from the neck down that they're pregnant and never mentions it, and then one day has a baby after 9 months of Zoom therapy. Fascinating. Patients who stand over and loom over the therapist on Zoom, where they could never do that really in the office without raising literal kind of alarm, right? There are new ways of working that involve these media, and patients are making use of them. Or a clinician friend of mine, Eric Linsker, who I write about in my book, who figured out ways to keep working with child patients, even when it seemed at first kind of impossible to move all of the kinds of play necessary to something that felt so static as Zoom. And he figured out ways to make it dynamic. I think that was what was really moving to me, was that people really were just trying to do the best they could. And it echoed with a lot of the history that I had seen. And of course, then the question, like all psychotherapeutic questions, is what do we make of it, both in terms of interpretation and in terms of what we keep and what we get rid of?
I think what's really interesting, Hannah, I've seen this over and over again, is that humans tend to conflate something being new with it being awesome. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, all what we retain versus what we let go of in the long run. You know, do we end up with sort of like a greatest hits in terms of the adaptations that have come about through sort of the Zoom era? What do we hang on to? What do we let go of? It's going to be really interesting to see that play out over time, because there is a novelty effect, right? Like, ooh, I can use a whiteboard and we can share this and share that. It may not wear well over the test of time, but, you know, remains to be seen as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think that that's right. That, you know, so much of this is going to be, you know, and our conversation has really focused, and I think we should say this, on models of therapy that relied previously on the office. So private practice, you know, the switch to telehealth and telemedicine had really happened at the hospital level, not wholesale, but before the pandemic, right? That there was a reason I was working on this book before the pandemic, and it had to do with turns that were already there. You know, in the book proposal for this book, then there are big economic figures for telehealth pre-pandemic, right? That this was already happening. And, you know, so some of that is going to be at this very small level of the clinician and patient, which will scale up because there are a lots of clinicians and lots of patients. Some of it's going to happen top down at the corporate level, as relates also to insurance and whatever insurance companies do, not just in terms of parity from mental health to physical, but for telehealth, mental health to in person. And, you know, those are the places that I'm more focused on in thinking through what's going to come next. I think clinicians do, you know, need to make these decisions based off of the patients they do know, as well as themselves. Some people really do not like working this way. You know, some people only like working this way now. The much bigger questions in terms of scale are about what's called the quote unquote ecosystem surrounding, you know, startups and telemental health and a kind of corporate wellness model that is getting further and further entrenched. And it's having really, I think, deleterious impacts on therapeutic laborers, especially those just starting out, and also on patients who are already more vulnerable.
That's a wonderful segue to my next question. I personally am extremely worried about the appification or commodification of mental health services via digital platforms. I mean, some of the problems are that, you know, there aren't magically more therapists. We still use the same therapeutic modalities. There's no sort of magic that actually exists around this kind of stuff, but there's a perception that it is. And I'm particularly afraid that organizations and employers are adopting these platforms without maybe really understanding the deep background of this, and then sort of patting themselves on the back for having a, I'm air quoting here, mental health strategy, without acknowledging the reality that care for serious mental illness is never going to be inexpensive. It takes time, and it's frequently quite nonlinear. And I guess one of the metaphors that I've trotted out at various talks that I've done around this is that it's like if your cardiovascular health strategy for an organization was simply to distribute an aspirin to everybody, and knowing that it will be perfect for some, it will overserve others and greatly underserve the most critically ill. So I was wondering, as a jumping off point, what are your thoughts on that particular conundrum, or how does that intersect with what you've been thinking about in this particular area?
Yeah, great. I mean, I don't know how much I can add there. You know, I worry about patient surveillance. I worry about the loss of a certain kind of clinical confidentiality because we've seen it. Not because I'm like so pessimistic, which I am, but because there's been evidence for this, you know, where every 3 months, it seems there's a scandal. But okay, great. It makes good copy, but it's horrifying where people's most intimate clinical material is leaked, or the fact even just that they're a patient, their email addresses are leaked. And for some people, that's the thing they've been trying to keep most private, right? There is still taboo, again, seeking mental health care, and for what? But also the therapeutic labor, because it's a scaling question. You know, I often get asked, not by clinicians, but more in mainstream media. So like, if you could change anything about therapy apps, what would you tell these CEOs? And I can't, because I would tell them not to be corporations, and they're corporations. You know, there are things I would say additionally, like I also worry about not just in corporations, but also in nonprofits, the turn to using data, datafication and geolocation, where, you know, they re-imbricate with policing, which in the US and in Canada is a major problem. You know, wellness checks routinely by the police, wellness checks in scare quotes, but that's the term of art, routinely end in deeply problematic racialized confrontation and also death. We don't want lethal wellness checks. It's a contradiction in terms. You know, the police as wellness check is a contradiction in terms. And that's the path that many of these corporations have set themselves down. I think precisely because, you know, it's a you know, trope at this point, but, you know, Silicon Valley moves fast and breaks things. And it is true that the US healthcare system and mental health care system in particular is broken. So I think it gives them this feeling of carte blanche, like anything we do is an improvement. And it's not. I mean, this was a very difficult thing in sitting down and writing this book every day, is actually not all help is better than no help. It's not true. You know, help can conceal violence, just like that idea of the wellness check that results in death. And I think that many of these corporate platforms are using the kind of escorting, democratizing promise of access, which of course has nothing to do with what's happening either in terms of their profits, in terms of their fee schedules, and certainly not in terms of their labor practices. And I really do worry about it.
I agree. It seems like these systems are set up to, they reward activities, if I can use that term, as opposed to outcomes. Basically, just, hey, everybody has access. There's a whole bunch of sessions going on, but it's not really clear that anything actually effective or productive is actually happening. It's sort of just this strange system of, we're okay with just, as long as activity is happening, all is well. And I very much agree with what you said before. Like one of the, I think, main pillars of our clinic is that something is not better than nothing. And that having people languishing in ineffective therapy actually can do tremendous damage, be demoralizing, and is completely unethical.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with you there. And yeah, so that's, I think, another, you know, the Psychotherapy Action Network in the United States is really looking into and is an advocacy group by psychotherapists. The women who run it are fantastic. You know, we need more advocates who are really thinking about the relationship to clinical life in general and for patients specifically. And then over in the UK, my colleague, Dr. Elizabeth Cotton, works on this specifically, re-therapeutic labor. And I just really highly check out those, recommend and urge everyone who's listening to check out those resources as well.
Excellent. I just want to dig a little bit deeper on this issue. This is something I've been thinking a lot about lately. The digital distribution of services appears to have created the potential for this winner takes all outcome, right? Because if you can digitize it and sort of copy something, you can distribute it so easily in a sense, right? That sort of access picture or piece we were talking about before. If it hasn't already, I fear it's going to create some sort of situation where a cost leader comes in and further commodifies mental health into the Walmart of mental health, or has a call center model or similar. I think you've alluded to this in other takes that you've had on different questions here. Basically, delivery of max volume with economy of scale that rewards activity and not necessarily outcomes. So again, I wonder if there was anything you wanted to extend around that particular idea or speak to based on some of the things that you've been thinking about.
Oh, certainly. I mean, it's a few different parts there. That activity thing is already there from the jump with CBT. So the history of CBT, really, like the clinical psychological history, is all about actually trying to get rid of the therapist. And it was built in as a media empire, right? So however one practices CBT now, that is at its root with Ellis and Beck, like in the history. And so I do encourage those who practice those modalities, you know, to think about the history and how it inflects their practice in the contemporary. I mean, such a big umbrella, of course, many different kinds of practice happening therein. But it's been taken up in the Silicon Valley space as a kind of gamification. I actually have an op-ed out today in the BBC Science magazine about gamification in mental health care, where, yeah, that's, you know, it's game, not play. And that's the distinction I try and make. And that's the problem. I mean, play is so central to the therapeutic encounter, and game is doing something else. But then this call center thing, yeah. So my colleague Todd Isig is very worried about that. Another thing happening in the US is that we don't have national licensure. So I don't know if you can practice in Quebec and also practice in British Columbia in Canada, if there's a kind of parity and reciprocal licensing.
At the moment, there's not, although in the context of the pandemic, many of the regulatory bodies have, in a sense, become more flexible or waive certain conditions just temporarily. For instance, I practice in Ottawa, Ontario. We are adjacent to Quebec. I could literally have a client 10 minutes away, but they're in another province. I wouldn't be able to see them technically. So there's been some provisions made around that. But technically speaking, if you're licensed in one province, that does not translate to another province automatically.
Yeah. So we have the same in the US with states, which are smaller entities than provinces. We have more of them. But this, you know, so lots of people, it makes sense, are pushing now for national licensure, right? Just like If you can practice in the US, you can practice in the US. And I look at the history of those worries about, they all come down to liability, typically around suicidality. Makes all the sense the second you say it. So there is the same kind of worries about indemnification, and it's the US, the most litigious country in the world, right? Where I'm talking from. I have colleagues who are not anti-teletherapy, are anti-corporate teletherapy, who are very worried about that national licensure because they think that it's, like Todd Isaac has written, I think quite persuasively about this, that it's the fastest way to pave putting call centers in the cheapest possible states, paying people even less. And, you know, people will say, well, that sounds dystopian, meaning it can't be true. And then, you know, I get calls from time to time from various corporate people asking to talk with me about my research. It makes, on the face of it, no sense to me. I usually take the calls because they're very interesting. And often it's more towards this idea of not just call centers of therapists, but call centers of not therapists who are using various kinds of software, right? We see this already with medical care, where the de-skilling of workers, putting them in call centers or even just in hospitals, has been part of the feminization of labor across the 20th century into the 21st. And so I don't think it's a dystopian worry at all. And it's interesting to try and think about the kind of points where, on the one hand, it looks like it would be very nice to have national licensure. Are you sure you want these side effects? Because we know that they will be exploited for corporate interest and capital gain. So again, that's why I think, you know, clinicians who are doing this advocacy work, so Todd Isaac is the person I just mentioned, Psychotherapy Action Network, these groups are really important to pay attention to. They're really thinking through all of these moving pieces.
Hannah, is there any sense that there is a conscientious way of deploying a model broadly? Or do you feel that at scale, it's impossible to retain the sort of heart of a model or the empathy or the focus on the individual?
I mean, I really like this question. Suicide hotlines, when they're successful, do that work where they are batch processing patients. Because of the kind of contingent call, but it's because the patient is regulating what they want to receive, and they're for free. So the minute you add profit to that question, I do think the answer is no. Much like the kind of, again, the saying, no ethical consumption under capital, I think that the minute we introduce the feedback in, it's very, very difficult to think of a model at scale that works. Especially because even the very small scale doesn't work, right? There are all kinds of patients who are turned away. Think about the psychoanalyst who turns away the schizophrenic patient, right? How would a corporate scaled initiative also enfold that person? So what we see instead are, and throughout the whole book, this came up again and again, broadcasts that, again, assume everyone basically is going through the same thing. Therapeutic scripts like run by chatbots that basically, despite machine learning, think everyone is going through the same thing, like called anxiety or different script, depression or different script, alcoholism or different script, eating disorder. Erasing the fact that many of those things co-present, that different people are going to need different things, and that none of those articulate a position on relationality or depth psychology or really getting to the deeper root of suffering. So all of this is to say is I don't think it's possible. And I think that by pretending it's possible, that is one of the places that we see a lot of harm introduced. It would be very different if someone said, here's my app that only works if you're 21 years old, middle class woman, cishet woman, and then you can use this app, right? Even still, I wouldn't believe it. But we never see that. We see this is great for everyone. And I think that fallacy is very painful and has a lot of the sort of problem associated to it. Yeah.
So, Hannah, one of the fantasies that I think I've been sort of playing around with is that you know, this idea of maybe having a mosaic of different intensity levels of treatment that are available for different people that would match their needs. So for instance, there might be huge swaths of the population that might be able to benefit from an app, but that we're not asking people with severe mental illness to plug into an app with some expectation that they're going to derive a benefit from it. So is it, it's like something like the right treatment for the right person at the right time. And that's going to have to be delivered in a number of different ways if we're going to have any hope of actually tailoring the treatment to what people need. Again, that to your point we made before, my fear is that this all gets funneled down into, well, we have this ICBT subscription for our for the company, that's what we're willing to support, when it greatly underserves what that person actually needs.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this was also something that continued to come up in my research, right? Is that people got to teletherapy precisely because they are interested in messing with that static frame. Like, what if it can't be between the hours of 8 and 7 p.m. in an office, right? The suicide hotline. What if, right? And all of the people who are interested in that mediatic flexibility were interested in these other kinds of flexibility you're talking about too, right? Winnicott constantly played with how many sessions a person should have, once a week, on demand, you know, 5 days a week. And he actually was against the once a week model. He thought it should either be on demand or all the time. You know, and a lot of people see that. And the problem is, of course, the rest of life doesn't allow for the kinds and qualities of care people need. And so we have to figure those underlying problems out. And also constantly, I think, be mindful of that in psychotherapy, that in fact, the care is going to fall short for many, many people, people who have access, let alone the people who do not, and continue to creatively think about how to make do with what we do have and extend it, but not by thinning it, right? Not by turning it into an app, but by, you know, bringing everything we have and the whole playbook of psychotherapeutic history in all of its many forms. To, you know, the idea is to meet the patient where they actually are and as they actually are, not in what would be convenient for the scale of apps. Yeah.
No, so well said. I know in our clinic, we employed a stepped care model where we really try to match the intensity of service with what the person actually needs. And that's a very much a data-driven perspective, because it's very clear that it's the frequency of sessions, not the number of total sessions, that determines whether someone's going to have a good outcome or not. So the danger, of course, is that, say, someone comes in the middle of a major depressive episode, they're in that once-a-week therapy model, and they're just dripping away their resource one session at a time, and that goes on for 8, 12, 14, 16 months, and they don't get any better. It might be better if there was a system to support them taking all of those individual interventions and crowding them maybe into 3 or 4 weeks, right, where we flood them with resources. And the data suggests that's the way to go with this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, again, the shape of you know, society is always inflected how therapy can be done. And so you can have all the data to the contrary saying, look, for many people, it's better this way. But if the rest of the shape of life doesn't allow for, say, a paid month off without someone losing their job, neither your patient nor the insurance company are going to be willing to front for it or do it or participate. And so I think, again, these are these other beyond the consulting room places that psychotherapists can agitate and think about their own relationships to society. And it's one reason why the idea that just now the social is coming back to the therapeutic is just a basic fallacy, because the social's there waiting outside and as well as inside, no matter what, right? It's literally shaping what's on offer.
And I have one more question for you, and it's a little bit open-ended, but I'd love to hear where you take the answer. If you were a practice management consultant, say to a group of psychologists, what conversations would you be having with your clients right now? What hard questions would you be getting them to wrestle with? What kind of risks would you be getting them to start to mitigate, and how? And again, very open-ended, but I'd just love to hear from your lens where you would take that conversation.
Well, I mean, it would be a number of things. I would really start to And it would depend, like, is the my client in this fantasy, are they coming because they want to get back into the office and they're trying to figure out how to do it as equitably as possible and like what the ethics are of doing a full-time return? Is it exactly the opposite, that the person has discovered that actually the stasis of therapeutic work is really hard to bear and they don't want to go back to the office? They like the fact that now they can, you know, move around more than just 2 weeks of the year, whatever it is, and really try and help them think through, you know, the ethics of access, what it would mean, say, if they are going to be a teletherapist and they don't have to pay for their office. Well, does that mean three or four of their hours or more can be sliding scale? Like, what are the interesting ways to make use of whatever their decisions are, right? You lose overhead. Can you decide to make less money for the greater good? And can we scale those things, right? Not at the corporate level, of course, but can many psychotherapists make those decisions? Because people are. So that would be one of the major things that I'd be interested in. And then if they were staying teletherapy, you know, I'd like to talk to people about, you know, what is it that they feel when they think they're feeling Zoom fatigue, which is something I write about in my book, right? Like what really is that fatigue? And is it about Zoom specifically, which I don't like, right? I don't like Zoom, but I don't think it's exactly Zoom that we don't like, in addition to it being like not a great platform. I think it's holding a lot of meaning. And same for people who are in a rush to get back to the office. Beyond just the questions of access and ethics, right? Like immunocompromised patients still can't go back to the office, right? Who are you leaving out implicitly and explicitly in those decisions? You know, to think about what can be brought with them rather than just thinking of the past 18 months as an aberration, because frankly, it went on too long if you're going back now. Something has to be integrated. So maybe we can close with this story that a friend just shared on Twitter, and then we talked about it on Twitter, which is like, right, that maybe we have to reconsider what our norms were for before from the pandemic. So if patients were on the couch, should they be on the couch now? A lot has changed. The couch has different meanings now that we've been alone for 18 months. If someone was doing really well with Zoom therapy, but wants to come back to the office and they were seated in a chair face-to-face, what about moving them to the couch, right? What are the various kinds of closeness and distance and their sort of timing, dosage, and interpretation that we can rethink now creatively and astutely to help patients who are also making these changes in the rest of their lives, going back to school, their kids are going back to school, or they're not, and how to really fully think through that myriad of implications? Because for me, writing the book on the history of teletherapy wasn't just because I'm deeply invested in the histories of psychology and the histories of technology. I am. But also because therapy is often a really extraordinary relationship. And it's an artificial relationship, right? One that we convene and then we remove ourselves from over and over again until we don't do it anymore. And therefore, it provides a real aperture onto relationships and relationality as such, and including how media are working there. And so to think through, like, what are these distances and closenesses like on the, you know, in mid-pandemic, in late pandemic? What was the suffering of isolation in early pandemic or non-isolation for emergency workers and so on? So I think all of that's going to really come up over the next several years. And I would just encourage folks to really think about all of the decisions they're making and all of their implications, and to get patients involved, to not make it just so top down, but to really listen to patients and then listen again.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your perspective, Hannah. If people want to find out more about you or the work that you do, where can they find you?
My website is zeevin.org. Z-E-A-V as in Victor, I-N. The book, The Distance Cure, A History of Teletherapy, is out from MIT Press, and it's available, you know, for order in local bookstores, but also on all of the big corporations' websites as well. And if you're interested in reading the book and don't want to buy it, you can request it through your local library, and that would be amazing.
Well, Hannah, thanks so much again for taking the time to speak with me today about your new book, The Distance Cure, A History of Teletherapy. I think safe to say a deceivingly deep topic with lots of different threads to pull on. I think we, in some ways, just scratched the surface today. There's a lot more that I think that is in the book that readers will find very interesting. So again, thanks so much for your time today. Take really good care.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take good care.
You too.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.